And we're going to interpret it as a sum over discrete manifolds. And then the question is, what are these discrete manifolds that we're going to sum over? We're going to take them to be fundamental, so the discreteness scale is not going to be taken to zero. We're not going to take a continuum limit. And because of that, we want the discrete manifolds to have some kind of naturalness. If you want to discretize the spacetimes that go into the continuum expression, and then define the theory as a continuum limit where you take the discreteness scale to zero, then you might argue that it shouldn't really matter the details of exactly what the discrete configurations are, that those details shouldn't really matter when you take the continuum limit, whether you discretize using whatever shape, say, you put into your simplicial complex type discretization shouldn't really matter. It shouldn't play a role in the end when you take the limit. But if you want your discrete manifolds to remain discrete and be fundamental, then and define the theory fundamentally, then they have to have some aspect of rigidity, an aspect of rigidness to them, because you don't want them to seem ad hoc, that you can just fiddle with some details of them. So that's what we're after. What are these discrete manifolds that are going to go in the sum over histories for quantum gravity? And I started off that, so the lecture yesterday was mostly about the continuum, and I quoted, but didn't prove, Viewer's theorem, which could be summarized in this slogan, which is that causal structure plus volume equals geometry. So this is a continuum result in the continuum. Okay. And then I took you through a couple of very simple steps. The first one was to consider just a distribution of matter described by a continuum mass density. And if we suspect that it's really atomic and really discrete in nature, then how would you go about finding out what that atomic state is and what the atomic theory is? Well, one way that you can start is just by discretizing. So I went through a couple of steps which describe that process of discretizing. And then the idea is to do the same for space-time. We take a continuum space-time and discretize it in roughly the same way. So we place atoms of space-time, which are conjectured to be identical, and have no structure in themselves. We put these atoms into space-time so that roughly the number of atoms that you place in any region is given by the volume, where you measure the volume in some fundamental units, and we'll take those to be near Planckian. We can satisfy this requirement of having the number of elements in any region of space-time being given by the volume by distributing these elements randomly into the space-time by a Poisson process called sprinkling. And let me remind you what the Poisson process is. So you can think of the Poisson process as a limit of a process where you divide space-time up into small volumes, small regions of volume epsilon each, and you put an element in each little volume with probability epsilon, and then you take the limit as epsilon goes to zero. So that's the Poisson process. We'll call that sprinkling. And this is what we ended with. It's a picture of 1 plus 1 dimensional Minkowski space-time, sprinkled with roughly 16,000 elements. And David made this picture, David Rideout. And this distribution is Lorentz invariant. It doesn't pick out any frame. And one way that you can understand that, or one consequence of that, Lorentz invariance, is that if you boost this distribution, then it looks just as uniform as this one does. So if you boost it, the this square will become elongated in one null direction and squashed in another null direction. But this distribution of elements will look the same. It won't suddenly break up into, it won't have big voids and more clumpiness. It will look, the distribution will look just like that. Yes.
So what about the dispersion? You have a new number, a new scale that fits the dispersion?
There's just one parameter, which is the in the Poisson process, there's one parameter. All the moments are fixed by that one.
Dispersion delta n over n?
It's the mean number of elements per unit volume. It's just the density. That's the one parameter. Root n. So the yeah the.
And where is the parameter?
The volume of the region.
So this is, there's no free parameter there.
No second free parameter.
There's no second free parameter in the Poisson process.
Where is the first one?
The density.
The number of points you sprinkle per unit value.
Okay, the second one is just root n. Delta n is root n.
I'm still a little confused how this is invariant number of proofs. I mean, the CMB is, you can think of something like this, right? Just sprinkling points, but it does pick out, right? It's not invariant number of proofs. How is this different?
So this is Minkowski spacetime. So
is it just because each of those points is a single point in space time, whereas you know, a new set of curves? That's the real difference. When you boost, you're gonna squash spatial volumes, the density of these points will go up spatially. So how does it actually work out? Does that make sense?
Right. So this distribution is a distribution in space time and not in space. So this is space time. Not just space. So it's true that that lengths contract and times dilate when you do Lorentz transformations. But volume isn't Lorentzian. It's a Lorentz covariant. So the volume of any region when you boost it remains fixed. So volume is covariant.
Look at the spatial density of points of a slice.
So it's difficult. I mean, if you like, there is no space here. I mean, if you drew a line of constant time, then almost surely none of these elements will actually lie on that line. So, because it's of measure zero, so the volume of a spacetime volume of a line is zero, and the probability that any of the elements will actually land exactly on that line will be zero. So it's actually one thing that causal sets don't do very well with space. It's very difficult to recover information about spatial hypersurfaces from a causal set from such an object as this. So there's you can't even really ask the question of what happens to the density of points in space. That's the okay. Are there other questions? Do you have a comment, Rafa?
Oh. No, I think it's. I was just going to follow up on that, but I think it's clear enough. I was just going to say that the spatial, when you think of space contraction, you're really thinking of an object made of world lines, and you're talking about the density of those world lines projecting into a certain
direction. Right.
It's the same comment you made before. In the case of the CMB, one is dealing with world lines, and here's one is dealing with actual space-time point events.
Right.
Okay. So even if you were to thicken the hypersurface a little bit so that there would be points in there, and then boost the whole thing, you'd still find the same number of points per unit spatial volume. Because some points went out and some came in. Instead of the world lines all sort of tilting over and changing their effective density.
Right.
Okay, so at this stage in our discretization of the mass of the matter in a box, we just took away the continuum mass density and we're left with the atomic state. And you can then propose that atomic state as the fundamental reality. But in this case, taking away the continuum means taking away the space-time, the whole space-time, the manifold and the metric that these points are in. And if you do that, then these points just, they have no structure. They just collapse into a heap of dust. So we can't do that at this stage. This structure, this distribution as it is not enough to encode the geometry of the space-time, or of Minkowski space-time in this case. So we need to add more structure to those elements, to these sprinkled elements. So what information could we add to this set of atoms to make the set hold its geometric form and not collapse when you take away the continuum space-time background? So the question is, what we have is number, the information about the number of elements in different regions. And we can ask, what completes that? And we know that because it's a Poisson sprinkling, the number of elements encodes the information about the volume of those regions. So we have volume information given to us by the number of elements. So what completes volume to give geometry? Well, causal structure. So I set you up for this, right? That was the whole point about going through those theorems, continuum theorems, is to give you an immediate answer to this question. It's causal structure which is complementary to volume, to number. So what we'll do is, once we've sprinkled our elements into the space-time, we'll endow those elements with the order relation that they inherit from the space-time causal relation. So if X and Y are two elements that we've sprinkled X and Y are two elements in the two points in the space-time at which we sprinkled, which we've chosen via the Poisson process. Then we endow them with this relation, which, just to be pedantic, I'm going to call something different, which is curly less than, and I'll call that precedes. So X precedes Y if and only if X is to the causal past of Y in the continuum, where this is the continuum causal information. So if your two sprinkled points are causally related in this way, then we give the pair XY, we say that the pair XY in the set set of atoms is related, X precedes Y. Okay, is that clear? So what you're left with then, if you just consider what the structure of the atoms is, that you have this set of atoms, you can label them, and then you can write down every pair, X, Y, such that X precedes Y, and that's all the information that you have. And in a sprinkling of Minkowski space-time, it looks like this. So this is another picture that David has made. I think there are 256 elements in this sprinkling. It's, again, just 1+1-dimensional Minkowski space-time. The elements are sprinkled via the Poisson process. And then what this picture is, there's a line, a green line, drawn between a pair of sprinkled elements if they're causally related in the background continuum causal structure. So if you want to know whether a particular pair of elements are, whether you should draw a line, you consider the light cone from the bottom point and see whether the top one is within the light cone or not. And if it is, then you draw a line. However, not all of the lines are drawn. So, for example, this one is obviously to the causal future of this one, but there's no green line between them because the relation between these two elements is implied by another set of lines, which I think, if I can read them off, I think this one is perhaps related to that one, and then that goes up to there, and then to there. So instead of drawing all the relations on, which would make the whole thing green and you wouldn't be able to see anything, You draw just the irreducible relations, the ones which are not implied by any of the other ones. And those relations we call links, or covering relations. That's another terminology for a link. So we just draw on the line if there are no elements, no sprinkled elements, which are causally between them. So we just draw the links. So this is a picture of a sprinkling into Minkowski spacetime with all the links drawn on. Okay. And if you like, the links are the nearest neighbor relations between these sprinkled elements, because this is directly related to that with no intervening element. There's no element that's causally in between them. This must be steady. This one must be space-like to that one then. Okay. And the thing that immediately strikes you about this picture is that almost all of these links are very, very close to being null. In most of them, you just can't, by eye, distinguish from being null. So they are slightly time-like because they're causal relations. They can't be space-like. So they're all slightly time-like. None of them are exactly null because, again, the probability, once you've sprinkled a point here, the probability of sprinkling a point exactly on its null, on its light cone, is zero. So you never get links which are exactly null in the embedding background spacetime. So all of these lines are time-like, but they're very, very, very close to null, most of them. And that's something which is intrinsic and somehow inherent to causal sets. It's the discreteness of the set, of this set of sprinkled elements, which brings out the fact that in Lorentzian geometry, this point is just as close to that one as this one is to that one. Right? So if you were to calculate the proper time between this one and one that it's linked to over there, then it would be of the order of the fundamental length scale, which is fixed by the density of the sprinkling. So closeness is in a Lorentzian geometry is illustrated by this picture in a way that I have never seen it illustrated in any other way. There's no, as I was saying in the last lecture, when you draw a space-time on a blackboard, or think about it in your mind, you can't help but endow it with Euclidean geometry. It's very hard to think about this and that point as being very close to each other, but they are. That's the nature of Lorentzian geometry. And it's only when you see a picture like this that you can really somehow appreciate it. Yes?
So can we understand the fact that most of these lines are almost null by saying that the causal relation is as irreducible as it is null? So to be irreducible, we need to pick up the ones that are as null as possible within the points.
You could, I think that's fair to say that. Are there other questions? So this closeness of points which in a particular frame look very far apart, so they're geometrically, in other words, physically close, but in the frame, in the picture, in the Euclidean geometry that you impose on it, just because you can't help it, they look far away. But it means that a causal set, meaning these elements together with their causal relate, the red elements, the sprinkled elements together with their causal relations, is inherently non-local. These links, these nearest neighbor relations, they stretch across the entire universe. So if you think of one of these links as perhaps being what a photon could do, if you like, a photon that's created at the time of last scattering and reaches our observatory today, it hops completely non-locally over all the intervening space-time and it doesn't pass through space-time in any way. It makes one jump from then to now. So Raphael has a nice aphorism, which is that a star is closer than yesterday. So yesterday was, you know, 24 hours ago. But the light from a star reaches us in, well, in this kind of picture, in a Planck time. So are there questions about this picture?
Could you clarify that last point?
Say it more clearly. Yes, well, in the continuum, of course, photons travel precisely on the light cone, and then there's no proper time at all passes for them, right? So in that sense, you know, the photon from the surface of last scattering is, you know, it's as fresh today as literally the moment it was born. Yes, it is now, right? That's right. So it doesn't even, I mean, yeah, that's... So it's right. So in that sense, it's, you know, it's much, much closer than this lecture yesterday, right? So that was.
It seems like there's a lot of structure emerging. Is that just an illusion? I just looked at the points, so it looks so random. But when I look at the green lines, it looks like there's a big blob in the middle of this big diagonal line there. Is that just random?
I think so, and it's also an artifact of the fact that this is just some finite piece. I mean, of course, the cause. I mean, if you sprinkled into infinite and across space time, then you know, then again, this whole thing would be green because you'd have links from points down here to points that are off the thing up there. So, yeah, I'm not sure there's any significance to the distribution of the lines. Are there other questions? So causal structure is Lorentz invariant. So if two points in space-time are causally related in one frame, then they're causally related in another frame. If they're not causally related in one frame, then they're not causally related in any other frame. So the causal structure doesn't disrupt the Lorentz invariance of the distribution. So again, no frame, by adding this information about causal order, no frame is distinguished. And this distribution is, again, Lorentz invariant. If you were to look at this in a different frame, then the points would be just as uniformly distributed as they are in this frame. And the links are, the elements which are linked in one frame are linked in linked in another frame. So are there questions about that? Okay. Now we throw away the continuum. So we have our elements, just some set of these sprinkled points, and their causal relations, you just write down the information, the pairs of elements which are related, and ask, well, what? And that's it. So you have no continuum information at all now. No coordinates, no lengths. Just that list of pairs of elements which are related. So what is this structure? And we want to propose this now as the atomic state, the discrete. Discrete manifold, which we're going to propose as the one of the things that we're going to sum over in the sum over histories. So what is it? Okay, well, it is a causal set. I've already been referring to it as a causal set. But let me give you the formal definition. So what we've created is a causal set. Causal set, or CORSET for short, is a set C endowed with a binary relation. It's clearly less than or equal to, or precedes, such that this relation is a partial order. And we saw that definition of partial order because the space-time causal order is a partial order, but I'll just write down the definition again. So partial order satisfies the condition that if x precedes y and y precedes z, then x precedes z. So that's transitivity. The relation is transitive. X precedes itself, and if x precedes y and y precedes x, then x and y are equal. That's acyclic. So there are no loops in the order. So this is the definition of a partial order. So a causal set is a partial order, but we saw that continuum space-time is also a partial order. So what distinguishes a causal set from a continuum space-time is an extra condition, which is that the cardinality of the set of elements which in the order are between any two elements is finite. If I define I, x, y, to be the set of causal set elements which precede x and are preceded by y, then that is finite. So where I, x, y is defined to be the set of elements z such that y precedes z precedes x. And this is called local finiteness. Okay, so in the picture, if you were to take an element, any two elements, this one, say, and that one, and count the number of elements which are which precede the top one and are preceded by the bottom one, so they're in the causal, causal future of this one and in the causal past of that one, that number is finite. And that, of course, that's not true for the continuum. In the continuum, you take a causal interval between two points, then there are infinitely many points because it's a continuum. There are uncountably infinitely many points. Okay. So now we propose to interpret Z, the continuum Z, dG e to the is G, as Z is the sum over causal sets e to the is causal set. Whatever this is. And I'm going to call this the causal set hypothesis. And, well, that's one statement of the causal set hypothesis. And it's due to...
Why do you choose this?
Aha. Well, we now have a proposal for SC, which I hope to be able to describe in a lecture on Friday if we have time. But even if we had no idea about this, we could still. I mean, we would be then seeking this. So we'd start with the proposal that the sum is over causal sets, and then look for the action. But we have a proposal for this now. So this hypothesis was made independently at least three times, probably more if we knew, by a Tuft, by Meerheim, and by Raphael and collaborators, Bombelli, Lee, Meyer, and Raphael. The more people that, the more times that it's independently proposed, the better, because it means that there's something attractive about it and that people come up with it independently.
Just a question, are you going to look for weights of processes which are purely unitary elements? Or, because usually when you discretize, you know, semi-classical weight would be that times the magnitude, which is the measure factor. And the measure factor is really, so in general, you're looking for complexity, and not necessarily the purely unitary number. Are you going to look for purely unitary? Or, see what I'm saying? Here you assign the weights.
You mean a weight here? For
exclusion ISC.
Yes.
You can call that omega C. So here you're assuming that this weight is purely unitary. The modulus of the guy is 1.
Yeah.
But in general, when you discretize, you don't have to do that because this omega C contains a measure factor. So
because you have, I mean, there's some combinatorial factor.
Yes.
Okay.
So are you going to assume that the modulus of omega C is equal to 1, the natural,
Well, I suppose it depends on what C is. If C...
I mean, generically, for any C, what are the properties?
I suppose, I mean, the honest answer is that we don't know yet. So, by causal set, of course, strictly, you should probably say it's an equivalence class of causal sets, which are all equivalent under causal isomorphism. I mean, between under causal automorphism. Do I mean no?
Isomorphisms.
Yeah. So then, I don't see why there would be a combinatorial factor arising.
The reverse. I say omega C. You can choose it to be purely unitary or not, and that's a choice that can be justified.
Yeah, I think the answer that they gave is right. We just don't know yet without playing around with it and seeing what results it leads to. But there is an analog, which I'll talk about, which is much better understood, which is a sort of stochastic, classical analog in which these weights are real. Called the classical sequential growth model, which I'll talk about probably not today, but maybe in the next lecture. There, a combinatorial weight factor does arise automatically. It turns out the amplitude takes the form exactly like that, except everything is real. It's like a Boltzmann waves. And then something in the exponent, and there is a weight factor preceding it, which is combinatorial. And in that case, it equals the number of natural labelings of the causal set. But that was a fine natural labeling later. But you could think of it as a number of possible orders in which the elements could have been formed consistently. In that particular case, it does take the form that you said, and there is a combinatorial way of measure of the left in front of it.
Yeah, the Poisson structure will tell you something about the volume.
So the causal set, the idea is that the causal set carries its own metrical information with it. So
9/10 is only 1/10 of the volume.
Right, so that, great, excellent point. So, but the volume information is recovered by the number of causal set elements. So because you can count, so in the continuum, right, in the continuum, the causal structure is 9/10 of the metric, indeed. And you have to add this extra information. You have to add the volume information to get back the full geometry. If you don't have this, then you just have this conformal geometry. Right? So you just, it doesn't give you back the full, doesn't give you back scale. So you need to add it explicitly. You need to add this extra information. In the causal set, you don't need to add it because it contains its own, it contains the volume information automatically because it's discrete. So you can count. So the number of elements in some region tells you the volume. It is the volume, if you like. So volume is the continuum approximation manifestation of the number of elements. So the number of elements is the real physical entity, and it manifests itself to us at the level of the continuum as the volume of space-time in a particular region. So because it, and that, that possibility is only available because the manifold, because the causal set is discrete, because you can count. In the continuum, you can't, I mean, because it's a continuum and there are infinitely many points in any region, you can't use that. There is no such information. But the causal set, because it's discrete, gives you that, it gives you volume automatically. So it contains within itself volume. That's it. So that's an excellent point. So, in fact, there's a nice slogan for that, too. We have lots of slogans. So the slogan is order. So that's causal structure plus number. So order corresponds in the continuum to causal order. Well, it gives rise to causal order. Its manifestation in the continuum is causal order. Number gives rise, it looks to us like volume. It's really number, but it looks to us like volume. That's what the idea is. And this gives us geometry. So this is the discrete version of this. But in this case, volume is something extra. In this case, it has number automatically. Yes? It involves sum over topologies. It involves sum over topologies and differentiable structure and metric. So the causal order proceeds, unifies within itself all of those things. So if you sum over all causal sets, then you're summing over all those things. But more than that, when you sum over all causal sets, you're summing over manifolds, spacetimes with different topologies and geometries, but you're also summing over vast numbers of things which have no manifold, like they look nothing like manifolds at all. So it's always the way when you give up something like the continuum, say, or unitarity, or any property of physics of current physics, once you give it up, you open a Pandora's box because the number of things, the number of states or configurations or possibilities is always now vastly more than the small set of states which satisfy the thing that you've given up. So when you give up the continuum, you invariably get some vast number of non-continua, of things that look nothing like continuum, as well as the things which you want to recover, the things which look like continuum. So this sum over causal sets isn't just a sum over manifolds and topologies and metrics. It's also a sum over lots of things that look nothing like manifolds. Yeah.
Here, you read me these things in terms of I guess you're imagining this closed manner. I mean, where I'm aiming to is that if you do quantum mechanics, not only you need the Pythagorean for closed finite loops or closed Pythagorean, you need Pythagorean which has also expressions on boundary states. You need to be able to say what are your boundary states, because these are going to become your quantum mechanical states. Right. So in your case, is there a way to extend this definition not only to a partition function, but to some expectation value where you have an initial state and a final state? And if so, what are the states you put in value?
Well, one of the motivations or basic ideas behind trying to make the sum over histories the fundamental entity in a quantum theory is to not consider it, as a propagator. So the sum over histories doesn't give you, its role is not simply to give you a propagator from one state to another state, but it has an interpretation and meaning in and of itself. So I should put this in inverted commas. In fact, this Z is not the thing that it turns out that in causal set theory we want to calculate. Exactly. But the whole formalism that underpins this the sum over histories approach is something which would require another lecture series. So it's a whole parallel story about the interpretation of quantum theory that we would like to apply to this, in which this is not the fundamental object. In fact, this partition function. So it's something different. It's something called the decoherence functional, which I'm just going to say that that's what it is. I'm not going to say what. Just going to name it. I'm not going to tell you what it is. But it's fundamentally, we're not going to be calculating the same sorts of things that people use the path integral to calculate in, say, quantum mechanics, where you calculate a propagator.
But you need a notion of state at some point. Not only the notion of partition function. So I guess you have
a, so we want to.
In
we,
this context, you have a definition.
We're building an interpretation in which the notion of state is not necessary. It's based on the histories themselves and on events or predicates or questions that you can ask directly about the properties of those histories. There's no fundamental notion of state in that interpretation. In certain circumstances, in certain situations, then you can recover the notion of state, but that it doesn't play any kind of primary role in the interpretation. I mean, these comments are all very obscure, obviously, because I'm not telling you what the alternative is. But that's, yeah. So I can't. Yeah, I need another series. Yes, yes. With causal sets, I think we're forced to, because as people are already pointing out, space, causal sets do very badly with the notion of space like hypersurface, that you would need to develop any kind of Hamiltonian theory that you could canonically quantize and use the whole apparatus of Hilbert space and self-adjoint operators and whatnot. So there's just no... A causal set has an inherently space-time character. It's just not amenable to dividing it up into space and time. It's not amenable to a Hamiltonian canonical approach. It simply cries out for to be treated as the quantum theory of it cries out to be treated as sum over histories, in which the histories are the primary objects. And there's no Hilbert space a priori. Yes.
Sorry, with this definition, how do you make geometrical sense of topology? Because usually with continuous manifolds, you just have local homeomorphisms to Rn, right? How do you do it here?
So at the level of the causal set itself, there are no homeomorphisms. I mean, it's discrete, so there's no notion of continuity at the discrete level. So it's only at the level of the continuum approximation that we can talk about topology and differentiable structure and metrics. So those concepts are in this framework, they're emergent. So fundamentally in the causal set, there are no open sets. There are no. It's not a topological space in itself. Well, it is a topological space, but in a different. Dimension will be emergent. So
there's only one model for dimension.
Good. So what would be lovely would be if these weights, if you had a weight for a causal set of any type, right? So of any dimension and no dimension, right? So with the non-manifold-like ones alike. That would be great. But the action that I hope I have time to get to and tell you about is actually a family of actions, one for every dimension, right? So we don't have the thing that would be the nicest thing, which is when it's even the dynamics itself is dimension free. Yeah. Are there other questions? Oh, is that really the time? Okay.
When I get to my lecture, I'll give an example of how to redimension information explicitly out of the causal set. So that'll maybe go somewhere to answer the question.
Good. Right. So let me. I don't know what happened there. I think I lost about an hour's time. Okay.
We started half an hour later than we normally.
Oh yes, we did. Oh okay. So I don't have to finish in half an hour. Oh okay, that's good. Okay. All right. Right. So as I was saying, in answer to your question. In this sum over causal sets, many of them are non-manifold-like, right? They look nothing like manifolds. And in fact, we know that the vast majority of them look nothing like manifolds, in the sense that if you take the set of all causal sets of cardinality n, so finite causal sets, cardinality n, then the proportion of causal sets of a particular peculiar type, which I'll tell you about, I'll tell you what they are in a minute, the proportion of those tends to 1 as n tends to infinity. All right. So the vast majority of causal sets of size n, where n is some large number, are of the following form. So most causal sets of cardinality n look like the following thing. They have three layers, and on the bottom layer, there are roughly n over 4 elements. So about a quarter of the elements live on the bottom layer. That means that they are minimal in the order. They have no elements that precede them in the order. And then there's a middle layer of roughly half of the elements, and these live above the elements in the bottom layer. And then there's a top layer of n over 4 elements. So there's relations between these layers. And that looks nothing like a manifold. If you like, it's something which lasts a couple of Planck times, if it's the universe at all. So it's really very unmanifold-like. And these are the vast majority of causal sets. So if you had a bag of causal sets of size n of them all and pulled one out at random, it would be like this. As n gets big, in the limit as n tends to infinity, almost surely you'll get one of these, something that looks like that. Okay. So in what sense are we claiming that this sum over causal sets is? So this was the statement of intent. Are we really taking this seriously as a statement of intent? This is a sum over continuum, space-times. Well, at the very least, some of these causal sets have to look like spacetimes. That's the very least. We know that there will be these non-manifold-like ones. And of course, we hope that they will be suppressed in some way, that these weights will be such that those ones will be suppressed. These are all just hopes. But at the very least, we must have some causal sets in the sum which are manifold-like. So are there manifold-like causal sets? Well, there are, and they are exactly the sprinklings. So if a causal set arises, is one which could have arisen by sprinkling into a continuum space-time, then it is manifold-like. So we say, so if causal set C could have arisen from a sprinkling process into some manifold, some space-time MG, and then you have to say with relatively high, to make this proviso, with relatively high probability, so it's a likely one. If C could have arisen from a sprinkling process, then M, then C and M are close. Okay. So we need that. And we also need, so if MG is to be a good approximation to C, we need that if C could have arisen from a sprinkling into MG, and it could have arisen from a sprinkling into M prime G primed, then these two continua are approximately the same. So MG is approximately M prime. Okay, now this is very vague, these curly equals, it's very vague. So then, but this is the central conjecture, or Hauptvermutung. Of causal set, of the causal set approach. Okay. So a colloquial, just to use words to describe this conjecture, is that a causal set, which is a sprinkling into a manifold, it encodes the geometric, it adequately encodes the geometry of that manifold, and that manifold is essentially unique. So there's no proof of this Hauptvermutung, and one of the reasons is it's actually difficult to formulate it exactly. Exactly what do you mean by saying that two Lorentzian geometries are close to each other? They're approximately isometric. However, we have lots of evidence. And I guess the strongest piece of evidence is the theorem that we have in the continuum. So we know that causal structure plus volume is geometry in the continuum. And what is a causal set? What is a sprinkling into a continuum spacetime? It is a Planck density random sampling of that causal structure. And if it's a sprinkling, then the number of elements that you sprinkle, the number of elements in any region is approximately equal to the volume. So the continuum theorem makes it plausible that this Hauptvermutung holds. And we also have a growing body of evidence that you can of practical techniques in which you can read out geometrical information from the causal set itself. So Raphael is going to tell us about a way to estimate dimension. So I'm just going to mention something about time-like. So we have time-like geodesic distance. So we have evidence for the Hauptvermutung. including the continuum theorem. So one of these pieces of evidence, so one is the way to read off the geometric info of time-like geodesic distance. So what is a time-like geodesic? Well, it's a curve between two points in space-time in the continuum. It's a curve which maximizes the proper time along that curve. So in the continuum. Time-like geodesic maximizes the proper time. Time like geodesic from x to y maximizes the proper time among curves from x to y. So here's x, here's y. Along the geodesic, the proper time is the greatest possible. And that's the opposite way around to the definition of a geodesic in a Riemannian geometry. There it minimizes the distance. Okay. So what's an analog in a causal set of that? So it's easiest to draw a picture. So here's a causal set. The way I'm drawing it is as a graph, or as a Hasse diagram for a graph, where each element of the causal set is drawn as a node or vertex of the graph, and each link is drawn, so not all the relations are drawn, but just the links, the irreducible relations. Each link is drawn as an edge or a line. And the convention is, and it's directed, of course, because the precedes order has a direction. And you could either represent that direction by putting a line on it, it's a directed graph, an arrow on the line from the past to the future, say, or a nicer convention, a sort of less cumbersome convention, is to draw the causal, to draw the line proceeding up the page or up the blackboard if x precedes y. So x precedes y, then you draw an upward going line from x to y. Okay. So here's a causal set. Show what I'm doing here. Okay. I want to have more. That's pretty simple. Okay. All right. So what's the analog of a time-like geodesic between two elements of the causal set, say x and z? Well, what's the analog of a time-like curve? A time-like curve will simply be a set of elements which are totally ordered. So all the elements are related to each other. So it's a path on the... A trajectory on the causal set, which goes up the proceeds along the links and goes up the page. So that's a time-like curve. And you just consider the set of all time-like curves, all time-like trajectories between x and y, and you choose the one which has the most steps. Okay. Now, in this case, it will be Well, there isn't the, yeah, this one. It'll be this one. That's the longest one. Okay. And that, sometimes it's ambiguous which one is, there'll be more than one trajectory which has the maximum the maximal length, and then you just choose one of those at random. Okay. And then you define, so let's define d z x to be the cardinality of the longest chain from x to z. So that's just a number, okay? And the and that does a very good job when the causal set is a sprinkling into Minkowski spacetime. And in the sense that, so this is a good estimator of time-like geodesic distance. In the sense that when C is a sprinkling into MD, then DZX. Now, of course, this is just a number. And as you take the sprinkling, we're going to take a limit now as the sprinkling density goes to infinity. But when the sprinkling density goes to infinity, then the number of elements between two fixed points in space-time, x and z, will go to infinity. And this d will go to infinity. So we have to rescale d by the fundamental scale, by the fundamental length. So you multiply this by the fundamental length, L, the fundamental length, where L is equal to rho to the minus 1 over d, where rho is the density. And this tends to some constant of order 1 times the geodesic distance, so times the continuum, which is just the length of the straight line between them. Geodesic time, proper time. As the density rho tends to infinity. And this constant, I think it's known analytically in two dimensions. But there are bounds, but no exact result for the constant in higher dimensions. But you can do simulations to find it approximately. Is that right? It's only known in two dimensions.
Yes, as far as I know. It's around two somewhere. Around.
So this result. You mean at the level of the.
Like D13, D1, D2,
and D2.
Yes. Yes. The Lorentzian one. Yes. Yes, I think so.
I think it's built into the definition.
No, Jenny, there is when you say the longest is just point, then you're counting the points except X and Z. So that it's zero for. I mean, I guess for this triangular inequality, it doesn't matter.
Oh, I see.
It doesn't matter what it's.
That's true.
What's your definition? So that the shortest paths are null. Is that the definition? So you're counting the number of things which are not X and Z.
Just count the links.
Just count the links. That would be that number.
I'm just saying for the triangular inequality.
I guess you're right.
Yeah, there should be one choice. Which number was.
So it might be minus 1 or something like that. Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It won't make any difference to these limits, but yeah. Okay. Yeah.
You want it to be distance.
That would be, that's nicest, yeah. Okay. So this result is due to Gregory and Brightwell. I can write that. Oh, they cite it. Oh, I see. So who is you? Is that right?
This paper on box cases.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
And they
said that this is a consequence of that.
I see.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
The paper on box cases is very well, is also very well. And Bolivar's.
So they point out its physical significance, I mean, its significance to causal sets. Yeah, okay. Very well. Okay, good. Right. So let me just make a series of basically comments about causal sets now. So here's our slogan, the fundamental slogan of causal set theory. Order plus number equals geometry. So causal sets are Lorentz invariant. The phenomenology that could come out of causal set theory will be Lorentz invariant. And that's in contrast to much of the phenomenology, what's called quantum gravity phenomenology, where people postulate that some uncertainty at the level of at the Planck scale, uncertainty in space-time structure at the Planck scale, can cause effects which we can which can build up over, say, the propagation of matter over long distances in the universe, and be measurable and observable by us. And that's a lovely idea. I'm very sympathetic to that. But often pretty much most of the time, the phenomenology that people consider is Lorentz violating. But causal sets are Lorentz invariant, so whatever phenomenology you can get out of them will be will respect Lorentz symmetry. So causal sets, they're maximally discrete. You need combinatorial data only. So it's just a set and a list of the pairs of elements which are related. So you only need to be able to count to do causal set theory. Whereas if you think about the number of steps that you have to go through to define a differentiable manifold, the contrast is quite stark. So you need to define real numbers from the rational numbers, then you need to define topological spaces, etc. Blah blah blah. So causal sets they're maximally discrete, but they're somehow very very spare. They carry their own metric information because they're discrete. And this was this is a reference to Riemann's inaugural lecture, in which he contrasts what he calls discrete manifolds with continuum manifolds. And he says that continuum manifolds cannot carry their own metric because they're continuous. So when you count things, I mean, you can't get any information out of them by counting. But discrete manifolds, you can. So because they're discrete, then they are somehow unified. Their substance is unified with the metric. So this order relation proceeds in the causal set, unifies within itself topology, differentiable structure, metric, and of course causal structure. Discreteness and Lorentziness go together like a horse and carriage. So if you like causal structure and feel attracted to causal structure as somehow being the fundamental structure in a continuous space-time that you'd like to survive, then you can't go all the way in the continuum with causal structure. You need to add this, it's a little odd, you have to add this volume information. It's not, causal structure is not enough in itself. The discreteness completes the causal structure, because if the if the order is a discrete order, then that gives you the exactly the right amount of information that gives that will recover the geometry for you. And on the other hand, if you start with discreteness, you just in the way that I set out, you just discretize the manifold and ask what structure could you add to the number to the number of elements. What structure could you add to give you back the geometry? Then you need the causal structure. So they fit together. They complete each other, and that's one of the nice. It's one of the. Well, speaking personally, it's one of the reasons that I feel that the structure of a causal set is not ad hoc. It comes about because of this connection between the two things of Lorentzian structure and discreteness. Okay, the randomness of the sprinkling process is kinematical only. So when you first hear about sprinkling, you think, well, maybe that's what the universe is doing. It's generating causal sets by sprinkling into some background secret space-time in the sky. But it's not. The sprinkling is kinematical. It arises in order to describe the correspondence between the discrete structure, between the causal set and the continuum. That's all it is. It's not dynamical in any way whatsoever. The generation of causal sets by sprinkling is to give us causal sets which look like manifolds. That's all it does. But it's not the way that the universe creates causal sets. So the dynamical rule for the physical dynamical rule that produces causal sets is some sum over histories with some weights or some growth process like the one that Raphael will describe tomorrow. Another thing that you might like to hang your thoughts on is that causal sets are fluid-like rather than crystal-like. So their discreteness is via... So if you contrast the molecular configuration of water to the molecular configuration of ice, then in the water, the distribution of molecules is random. In the ice, it's lattice-like. So the causal sets are more like water than they are like ice. Causal sets embody this notion of scale-dependent topology and geometry, and something I'll call coarse.
Yes.
I don't have anything else to say apart from the fact that the distribution of molecules is random in a...
In the picture you showed, that they look very regular with all these kind of null lines. So in that sense.
So the... It's simply the fact that the causal cell elements are distributed randomly in the space-time. They don't have a regular structure. I mean, you could imagine, and people do, imagine discretizing space-time by a regular lattice, right? So, like this, say, in two dimensions, right? So here are the atoms. And here are the edges, so it's some graph. So I would say that's a crystal. I mean, I don't mean anything. Actually. I mean anything more than just putting a picture in your mind. So this is a crystal-like structure. So this, if you want to discretize space-time in this way, then I would say that you're thinking of space-time more like ice. That's. Do you have anything you want?
I was just thinking, so I think the structure, you're right, the picture seemed to have a lot of structure. But I think the structure that you're seeing is the structure inherited from the space-time itself. I mean, space-time has distinguished directions, which are the null directions. Mm-hmm. And those were somehow
houses
showing up in that diagram. But if you talk about the correlation, if you were to ask for whether there's any correlation between, in that sprinkling, between the location of one sprinkled point and another sprinkled point, then there's not. Whereas in this kind of case, there is. So in this case, for example, the translation group is broken down into some discrete subgroups of the translation.
Yeah.
Whereas, the, as Faye mentioned, I guess last time, in the case of the sprinkling, it doesn't distinguish any particular frame or break the underlying Poincaré invariance of the space-time, which, of course, preserves that structure that you see in the picture, which is the null forms.
So I'm going to illustrate this comment about scale-dependent topologies with an example. And hopefully the general idea will be clear, which is to sprinkle into a cylinder. So it's a two-dimensional space-time. Space is a circle, and time is just the real line. Cylinder universe. And if you generate a causal set by sprinkling into, it's just flat, sprinkling into this, at high density, you sprinkle, you endow the sprinkled points with their inherited causal relations, then you take the cylinder away, and you're just left with the causal set. Then you apply, that causal set will be manifold-like, and the manifold it will be like is this one, the cylinder. And if you apply the dimension estimator that Raphael will describe to it, you'll get two, or very close to two. If you take that causal set and you coarse grain it by taking each element in turn and throwing it away with a certain probability, okay, say probability a half, right? So you take the causal set and you go through each element in turn and you just chuck it out with probability half, then you'll get another causal set. That causal set will again be a sprinkling into this cylinder. It will be embeddable in the cylinder, but at a density that's half the original density. If you keep doing that, keep coarse graining and coarse graining and coarse graining, eventually the causal set that you'll end up with will be like this. So it'll be a chain. And if you apply the dimension estimator that Raphael described to that, you'll get one. So you start with a causal set, which has dimension 2, but if you coarse grain it enough, then you end up with a causal set which has dimension 1. What happened in between? Does it go monotonically from 2 to 1?
I think so. Yeah. Doesn't say that, aren't there some simulations by David Meyer?
Okay.
Or somewhere in the paper.
That's nice.
Crossover, not a phase transition, so to speak.
Okay. So this is something that we're used to in physics. The concept, at least, so it's the same concept that underlies Kaluza-Klein theory. If you look at this space-time at certain scales, so scale small compared with the radius, then it looks two-dimensional. But if you look at it at larger scales, scales large compared to the radius, then it looks one-dimensional. And causal sets embody this in a precise way via this coarse graining. So the concept of this coarse graining of the causal set, where you just take out points at random according to some fixed with some fixed probability, that's something which is covariant. It doesn't depend on any choice of coordinates, and it precisely embodies this notion that at different scales, the same manifold can have different topologies and different geometries. Okay. And I just want to comment that causal sets are both conservative and radical. So they're conservative in the sense that you... Yeah, sorry.
I have a question on this.
Yes.
So a number of different approaches to probability, one proves that one-dimensional manifolds reduced to something like two dimensions in the vicinity of the Planck scale.
So, because we don't have I think that question has to be addressed in a sort of in a dynamical, in the context of a particular dynamics, I believe. So it would only be in the context of a certain dynamics for generating causal sets that you could explore those questions. But I mean, David has studied the causal sets that arise from a particular kind of dynamics, which is a stochastic classical dynamic, so not quantum at all, where you grow causal sets by adding one element at a time in a certain way, in a stochastic way. And the causal sets that arise have a very, you can see that they have a very different structure on the small scale. They're one-dimensional, David?
Yes.
On the smallest scales, they're one-dimensional, but on a large scale, there's some evidence that they have some four-dimensional-like properties. So yes, that kind of thing could certainly come out of causal sets, but there's no.
It's a space-time dimension for one. You mean at the smallest scales?
Yes, it's just time, I guess. Yeah.
Yes, although the other results generally use the spectral dimension, which is a bit different than the sort of dimension that we're using for causal sets. So it may be a manifestation of the difference between spectral dimension and the sort of dimension.
So this is a comment like this one. I can't justify it, really, but it's just my feeling that it's conservative because you take space-time and you don't, as the real thing. It's just that now it's discrete rather than continuous. It's not a proposal in which space-time is replaced by something completely different, like a collection of D0 brains. Or it's conservative because you're preserving space-time as the thing we're talking about in quantum gravity. And yet it's radical because it's saying we have to propose something that's very, very... It has very little structure, seemingly. There's just this order relation. We're proposing that you can get absolutely everything from that. Right. Okay, that I'm going to take 5 minutes now to... I'm just going to say a bunch of stuff, which we're not going to talk about at all, but if you like the sound of any of it, then we can talk more at lunch, during the afternoon, at dinner. So there are two parallel stories to... at least two parallel stories to the sort of the story of causal sets. And one is about topology change, so... I've just sketched that here by... it addresses the question, can the topology of space change? It involves the fact that you can get spin half and fermionic statistics from pure gravity, or pure space-time, if you like. It involves the question of the spin statistics correlation and, in general, the hope of getting matter from space, from space-time alone. Okay, so that's one parallel story that goes along with, alongside causal sets and is related to it. And then the other story is the one that I tried to sketch a little bit when I was answering Laurent's question, which is, what is the nature of quantum reality? How do we interpret the sum over histories without reference to any such thing as a state at a moment of time? Without any fundamental role for Hilbert space. What is the meaning of relativistic causality in a quantum theory, and can we build a relativistically causal quantum dynamics causal sets? So there are these two parallel stories which are happening at the same time. And then finally, this partial list of further questions. Another thing, if any of these are appealing to you, then we can say more about them, pretty much them all, more or less, actually, less about some, but... So causal sets throw a different light on the cosmological constant problem, and hopefully Raphael will get to say something about that perhaps Thursday. Does that seem likely?
Yeah. Okay. It's possible. Yeah. I'm not sure how far we'll get.
And what about the non-locality, that picture of the links, the green links, shows that causal sets are very non-local. But non-locality But we don't see any non-locality, and as far as we know, in all our best physics is local physics. General relativity is local. So isn't that a rather worrying that causal sets seem to be inherently non-local? I'm hopefully going to talk a little bit about that on Friday. What's the quantum dynamics of causal sets? For example, you could say, what is the action? What's the S of C that appears in the sum over histories? Is there a problem of time for causal sets? Is the passage of time physical, or does space-time exist timelessly in a block, and what we experience as the passage of time is merely an illusion? Why is space-time four-dimensional? Why are there no holes or boundaries in space-time? What does the black hole entropy count? What about holography? Is there something about causal sets that could throw light on the question of what are the fundamental microscopic degrees of freedom that are associated with hypersurfaces like light sheets that could give you entropy, the sorts of entropy bounds that people have studied? Can we detect the discreteness already? So this isn't actually, it's probably another parallel story, a whole parallel story, is that what's the phenomenology of causal sets for astrophysics and for cosmology? It's going to be Lorentz invariant, so it's different from the sorts of quantum gravity phenomenology that that others have studied. And we have ideas about what sort of phenomenology can come out of causal sets. If you like, doing causal set quantum gravity phenomenology is easy because we have a very concrete proposal of what space-time is like. It's a causal set, a sprinkling into Minkowski space-time or a Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe. And if you want to do phenomenology, you can just put stuff on that causal set and see how and make a model of how it would propagate, for example. And then finally, what happened before the Big Bang? Causal sets allow you, they bring up new ideas about for cosmology with no added scalars. So a lot of proposals in cosmology seem to involve adding another scalar field. So causal set, there are indications from causal set cosmology which do without extra scalars. Okay, that's it. So yeah, if you want to talk about any of these things, then we love to talk about them.
Just an announcement. I intended to prepare a bunch of glossaries of different mathematical terms or definitions that are useful. And I did, but for some strange reason, I could only get it to the printer by mailing it to myself at Gmail, where I don't really have an account. I mean, so don't write to me at Gmail. So I'm going to make better copies tonight and bring them tomorrow, but there's about 8 here, so if anyone wants the first edition, you can just pick them up on the way out.